Item number 17, predator prey management, and that's a briefing. So, Mick?
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. For the record, my name is Mick Cope. I'm the Game Division Manager with the Department. Wanted to take a few minutes of the morning here to just give an introductory briefing on predator-prey relationships. Here's our outline for this presentation. Want to provide an overview, a history. Brief history of ecosystem function, and a look into the science of predator-prey relationships. Give a couple of examples of predator-prey management that is currently going on in Washington, and then I'll dive into our predator-prey management guidelines that are in our game management plan, as well as in our wolf management plan. Touch on those. And then just provide some insight on some next steps and our ungulate assessment and our predator-prey investigations that we have on before us as an agency. Just go back a little bit in history. Predator-prey management has been something that's been debated for many years when in the wildlife management arena. This agency was created in 1933, and it was a point of discussion at that point. There was, in the 20th century, predators were aggressively harvested and a variety of means used to manage that component of the ecosystem. But in the early 1930s, nationwide, there was folks raising the concern of excess control. That was brought into modern wildlife management. And in the 60s and 70s, there was more discussion about the vital role that predators played in the ecosystem function, and the control, predator control management went from more of a very broad-based approach to much more individual-focused approach. Ecosystem function, it's predator-prey relationships are very complex. This is not a very high quality slide, I admit, but it's about these are about prey that are the size of a bread box. If you're the size of a bread box, there's lots of things that want to eat you. There's a variety of predators, but when you think about the predator on a bigger scale, bigger animals, there's still a complex ecosystem interactions between habitat and the herbivores that are on the landscape, and then the variety of predators that end up working with eating those animals. But then I didn't even include the arrows that go between even the predators. So it's a complex system that we don't completely understand, but there are some general things that folks, wildlife managers, do to look into this and manage predators and prey on the landscape, and go through this science in a fairly quick way. I'm going to review some basic principles and some concepts and theories on predator-prey dynamics. I'll summarize some of the studies that have been done in the West over the last handful of years, and review some characteristics of predator-prey impacts. To start off, just with a introductory part about some terminology. Prey growth rates, So, you know, ungulates, deer, and elk, as they, there's kind of this growth curve where you have kind of exponential growth in the prey density is it can increase based, you know, in a variety of situations. This can be caused from good habitat conditions or occupying new areas or variety of things could cause this, and then you end up into a spot where the population reaches a point where you top out, but that has a kind of a, there's a little bit of a lower stable population, there's an increasing population, and then it could end up being stable again at a higher rate. That dotted line on here is kind of this habitat carrying capacity concept where the population is a little bit, is limited by some of the resources that are available. That prey population can get up into that carrying capacity and kind of level off. And the kind of the concept of additive and compensatory mortality. In this graph on the screen, the difference between additive and compensatory, additive mortality, each individual mortality factor adds directly to the total mortality, so that's this sharper declining population. So different mortality sources come in, whether it's additional predators or hunting or something, could, if it's kind of causing this kind of a population trajectory, then it's additive. There's the compensatory side where the mortality from one factor may be compensating for another, and that's typically where we're at with the hunting aspect of things, is we live in kind of this compensatory time when one mortality factor kind of compensates for another. Up to a certain point, then you can end up getting into additive mortality at some point as well. So there is a limit to that in cases. In a conceptual model, not something specific here, but and that the prey growth curve that we had talked about just a little bit ago, that compensatory mortality tends to happen when you're kind of higher up on the population numbers. Additive mortality tends to happen during this kind of lower population curve, or this where it's even potentially growing at an exponential rate. Other kind of models that are out that exist out there, this one is something that is typically when you learn through ecology and you're looking at a lynx snowshoe hare cycle where the snowshoe hare population increases really mild winters and they do really well, but then it kind of gets the population starts crashing because of severe weather, and then it goes back down, and then the prey cycle is actually right behind that, and it kind of cycles a little bit out of phase, and but it still follows the trend of the prey. Another type of model that we see sometimes are kind of this low-density equilibrium where you start off and you have a population that's at a low density. It can raise, and then for some factor, it comes back down, but then it doesn't ever really come back up. It doesn't cycle like that snowshoe hare example, and it remains kind of at this lower density equilibrium. There's also models out there where a prey species may have a low population and it's kind of bounced along at this lower equilibrium. Then something happens and the habitat quality goes up, or some factor changes and the population goes up. And then even if that factor changes, it may stay at that higher level as well. And it's kind of gets up over the hump of whatever it was that was holding it down here. So we back a few years ago, we did a fairly extensive literature review. I'll kind of step through those and talk about some common themes that were in that literature review. Some of the primary ungulate predators and on some of our main focus species for ungulates. And then talk a little bit about what the characteristics are in a population that is potentially being regulated by prey. Or that is, prey that are being regulated by predators. So there were 35 studies that we looked at over almost the entire Western U.S. And there were eight kind of comprehensive reviews of those 35 studies. In all eight cases, there was an acknowledgement that predation can limit ungulates. There's evidence to that. One thing that also came through is that it's a fairly rare occasion that predators hold down ungulate populations. Some things that I'm going to touch on just on different species, but in those studies, 18 of those of 21 deer studies that we looked at did have coyotes as a primary predator on deer, especially on fawns. They're one of their key prey species or prey items. Extensive work on by Zager and Beecham that showed black bears as having the primary mortality factor for elk in the area that they studied, and it was typically again on kind of those newborn calves or the young calves. And there were 5 of 14 studies that looked at deer and elk, and 5 of those 14 studies believed that there was a limiting factor for cougars on deer, but not in the elk study. None of the elk studies showed that, and it's just a kind of a prey item size issue there. So it didn't seem to be as big a deal. And a couple of other noteworthy findings in these research papers that there are events that do dramatically lower carrying capacity in a temporary manner. So kind of catastrophic fires change the landscape in a way that at least temporarily reduces the amount of available forage. Many of those fires will come back and have, be good habitat later, but in the shorter term, there is an impact. There's also events that happen that change the vulnerability of young ungulates. So big snow winter, young animals aren't able to move around as well, so they're more vulnerable to predation. So those things also were borne out in the literature. So it's time to step into kind of when is predation a likely factor, and what are the things that we tend to look at? Again, bring back this population growth curve that we talked a little bit about earlier in talking about the compensatory and additive mortality. And in those situations, this column on the left side, on the left here, is some characteristics of ungulates where predation could be the limiting factor, and on the right side is kind of where population size is mainly affected by the available habitat or resources that are available. So we can look at things like the physical condition of adult female animals. When you have a population that's limited by predation, the animals are usually in pretty good health. Body fat condition is higher. And if you have some, it's kind of intuitive that it'd be if you're limited by your resources that you're not going to be in as good a physical condition. Some of that also relates back to if you're in poorer physical condition, then your pregnancy rates are probably lower and your production is probably lower. Whereas if the population is held down by predation, then you're still in good body condition. You're still producing you're producing young, but those young may not be living as very long. You do have lower litter size. So this is about lots of different prey species, not just deer and elk or moose. But in general, your diet is better. The diet quality is higher than those areas. One of the things you need to look at is what is the available forage and that kind of thing in the area. So we kind of look at, I'm trying to build this kind of a decision matrix flow chart here that kind of walks us through some logic. We kind of start off here at the top thinking about the ungulate population objective. We have deer and elk herds throughout state, moose, sheep herds. that we look at and we can look at, is the ungulate population meeting the population management objective? If it's meeting the population management objective, it's probably then not likely to be a candidate for being held down by predators. But what if it is below objective? Then you kind of need to start looking into things a little bit deeper and thinking about, well, is it something to do with habitat quality? Is it something that there's that additive mortality going on, and what is that additive mortality? One of the things that with our ungulates, we hunt them, right? So one of the things that we can do is look at adjusting our ungulate hunting seasons. And if we change that dial a little bit and we get a response with the population by changing that source of mortality, and it shows that dense kind of density-dependent response, where then it's probably not a limiting population, it's not a population being limited by predators. But if that doesn't work out and we've adjusted that dial and it still has not, and it didn't respond, and then you just need to start looking at what kind of mortality factors are associated with the newborns. Are you having high loss in predation of those newborn calves or fawns or not? If it isn't, if that's not the major source of loss for those newborns, then it kind of puts you over to the right-hand column and going back down to not likely. So if you're kind of looking at that and newborns are being limit, you know, major factor of predation of newborns is is predation, then you kind of taking a look at the predator population status and whether the predators are, if that predator population is declining or is it increasing or staying stable. If it's a secure population, then it kind of puts you down into the green box here, where there's a likelihood that predation is affecting that population growth. So that's just kind of some steps, logic steps that we walk through, and that'll come back in a little bit later. So what are the things that we can do as an agency to kind of help inform this? Well, kind of the least informative thing, but something that is a good first step, is that we can compare population trends in ungulates and predators. We can also look at the estimated mortality rate of those ungulates due to predation, which whether it's even the neonates, the newborns, or adult mortality, and we can investigate that. We can also look at experimentally reducing predators in measuring ungulate survival and any changes that happen in those populations. And then finally, we kind of on the most informative, we could experimentally do predator reductions and compare two areas and the response of those ungulate populations in those two areas. The thing that comes along with that, though, on this most to least scale, is that the number four option is also the most expensive in taking the most resources as well. So you kind of have to look for that balance in there, and we need to do that as we move forward. So I'm going to transition into talking a little bit about predator prey management and give you some current examples of things that the agency currently does, or maybe not just our agency, but federal agencies. We're going to talk a little bit about population growth characteristics, and then I'll step into our management guidelines. So the examples of predator prey management, we have programs where we're looking at sea lion control and to benefit Chinook salmon in the Columbia River system. We also have sage grouse populations that are very, very low, and we have predator control programs to help bring those, or to help manage those species, as well as pygmy rabbits. It's a situation where the populations are very low, looking to try and get these animals over the hump. A fairly new issue of controlling barred owls to benefit spotted owls, and an issue on the coast where we have snowy plover that are very, very, very low populations, and looking at raven control and how it's tied together with some work that was done down originally in Oregon and California, where they've had success controlling ravens, and we've tried that here in Washington and are seeing success as well. So it's not something that's new to think about predator prey management in many different scenarios. You've seen this graph a little bit earlier, kind of that multiple level equilibrium, where you may have a population that's regulated by predation kind of down here at this lower level. But if you increase that predator removal and you manage that predator population and you're looking to get this growth curve, and then at some point if you stop predator control and you've kind of got them over the hump and get them over the hill, then they can continue existing up here at a higher plane. That's kind of maybe in contrast to a situation where you have low equilibrium population, you do some predator control and it raises up here, and when you stop predator control, then it population of predators gets back up and the population comes back down. One of the reasons I wanted to try and bring this one out is because this is predator control can be a long-term commitment. It's not necessarily going to be this curve all the time. There's a part of this that when you walk into it that you need to think that it's going to be potentially a long-term commitment to management. So our agency management guidelines are in our game management plan and in our wolf plan. I'm going to kind of summarize some of the kind of salient points here from those two plans. First of all, we would be managing predators and prey for long-term perpetuation of the species. It's not looking to eliminate something from the landscape and just to benefit the other. We want to take and manage predators for a variety of recreational, educational, and aesthetic purposes. That's kind of looking at everything from traditional hunting to our Native American co-managers and their values to observational, enjoyment to hunting enjoyment. So we're looking at all of those different pieces. And I want to continue to try and improve our understanding of predator-prey relationships. We don't want to put any of our management in a situation where we're not learning something from it as we go forward. In the game management plan specifically, it recognizes that predator management is a viable tool. We have criteria that are written in the game management plan that provides that direction for when we would recommend actions to achieve ungulate population objectives. They're fairly extensive, but I wanted to provide some of those guiding principles in here, kind of boil it down a little bit. Again, healthy predator and prey populations is a key. Management of predators is considered when there's evidence that predation is a significant factor, so it's not just kind of a guess. We want to make sure that things are well understood and we have specific goals in mind. We have keep in mind our conservation, overriding conservation goals, as well as economic and recreational values and societal values. This isn't done in a bubble. We're not looking at doing this without considering all the different perspectives. And that we'd be using scientific principles when we approach this kind of management. Again, we don't want to go into a situation where we're not learning something as we move along. If we were to implement something, we'd need to first start out by describing the problem and the rationale for that proposed action. This is all written into our game management plan, where we'd need to identify the status of the predator and the status of the prey and describe kind of what would we be expecting if we move towards predator management. We evaluate the factors that are ecological as well, both the predator side and the prey side, and then looking also at a determination whether this is something that needs to be a kind of a population level management or more of an individual level management. And that varies by species, right? If there's situations where maybe one particular individual is something that could have an impact on something. Maybe a good example is bighorn sheep. Fairly limited habitat, could be a specialist, predator that's having an impact on what may already be kind of a group of of sheep that are on kind of the downhill because of pneumonia. So we're thinking about all of those different pieces of it. That's when we look at defining what the issue is, the boundaries and the objectives of that management plan, and then what do we think we might, what might happen, and kind of anticipate those effects of management. And then, again, tying back to the fact that we don't want to do things without learning, that we're developing a monitoring plan so we know if we're successful or not. And through all of this, there's public review and public involvement. In our wolf plan, we have a section that is our wolf ungulate interaction section, and it kind of defines and describes what predation, wolf predation on ungulates is like, both kind of in theory, but also in kind of recent impacts of wolves on ungulates in other states. There's a kind of a review written in there. It also provides kind of an early look and maybe a cursory look at status of ungulates in Washington. But it also has portions of the wolf management plan talk about estimates of predicted wolf predation on deer and elk, and describes some of the management tools that could be available to the agency for managing wolf-ungulate interactions. Most of that direction is related at at-risk populations, and at-risk is defined within the plan. It has some criteria in there about T&E species, threatened endangered species, or population of ungulates that are 25% below population objectives for a couple of years. So it does provide some guidance and some direction in those two documents. But that kind of takes us towards what are our next steps, what are we doing now as an agency, and I would talk briefly about our ungulate population assessment. I mentioned that the Wolf Plan kind of had an introductory review of that, but this is a kind of a more in-depth piece, and then kind of the what our next steps are for some predator-prey investigations that we're investing in. In our game management plan as well, we have an objective in there that in the quote is here to identify herds or local populations that are below population management objectives where predation might be a factor, a limiting factor. So that actual objective is in four chapters within the game management plan, within the deer, the elk, the bighorn sheep, and the moose chapters. We've stepped forward in the last 6 months in our staff, both in our deer and elk section, our bighorn sheep and moose section manager, as well as field staff, have reviewed, and they're getting closer toward the end here by utilizing our existing population surveys that we conduct for these species. We have some ongoing studies where we have radio collars and investigations going on with a variety of these species, moose and deer, elk, all three of those, and then also taking in some of our kind of our biggest data set, which is our harvest statistics, and looking at trends in harvest and trends in population, kind of projecting those populations. So using all this existing data that we're going through an evaluation of all 10 elk herds. We're looking at deer species on our deer management zones, whether they're white-tailed deer, mule deer, black-tailed deer. We have 16 sheep herds that we have actually a pretty good handle on all of those. They're fairly contained. Some of those herds, I said, are being affected by pneumonia, so that's kind of complicating factor. And we're evaluating moose on a more general, we don't have herd plans for moose, but looking at their productivity, we do have a study going on with moose over north of Spokane, as well as we have some flights that we do as well. And the goal is to have this evaluation done, this ungulate assessment done this spring. Once we get done doing our work on the initial piece, it's also going to be put out for external review with the University of Washington panel. To have them go through, we'll make a presentation with them and have them review our work and give us any insight that they have. In addition to kind of that initial ungulate assessment, we've dedicated funding and to investigate three main objectives with predator prey. The first one is to identify ungulate population response in areas, well, population response due to wolf colonization. So likely that this hasn't been developed. We're kind of looking at our main objectives, and we're working with both universities and internally. As a matter of fact, I think I put them on here, our cooperators with the University of Washington, Washington State University, and University of Montana. So this is in the early stages of developing things, but our main first goal is to give us some tools to be able to not only say right now if there's differences in areas that are being colonized by wolves and or not, but tools for the future. And how can we monitor over time, or what are the tools we can best use to monitor over time changes in ungulate populations? But we can't do all of that just in a kind of an animal based, you know, either predator or prey based investigation. There needs to be some kind of association with changes in habitat and what that may do also to predator prey. As we mentioned, probably heard a few times, reference to Carlton Complex fire or Okanagan Complex fires. Some things like that have provided, have created very big changes in habitats. And so we need to consider how that may play into this predator-prey kind of collaboration. So the third objective is that at the end, one of the end products is looking at having a model that we can look at prey response to different predator manipulation. So if we were to turn the dial on one kind of predator management, what kind of response would we expect via modeling for an ungulate population? So we're working with these cooperators, looking at these questions and these objectives as we move forward. It's just getting started. With that, I'd certainly entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mick. I felt like I was back in the 300 level wildlife.
Yeah. Only 300. I didn't get very far.
It went up from 200 at the end, but there's no test at the end of this one.
So excellent. That's good.
Thank you. Question? Yes.
Thanks, Mick. That was great. I mean, this is something that I've looked forward to for a while, is having a conversation about these complicated principles, theories, approaches in wildlife predator prey management. I have so many questions, I don't think I'll be able to ask all of them, but I'll start with the one. There's a flow chart where you provided, you start with the ungulate population objective, and then you, if you're meeting it, you go one way. Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
So if we're not meeting our population objective, we look at ecological carrying capacity. I'm not sure if we can determine that, but you get a guess of whether it's gone up or down. And then our first step is to reduce hunting. That's the easiest thing we can do. But one of the questions that immediately came to mind was, that is such a value-laden concept. What is the appropriate level of hunting? What is how much we can reduce that in good conscience? Because some would say, I would call us the other apex predator, mm-hmm. along with, I mean, put us in the food web too. Human beings as apex predators along with wolves, that in our world we're a special kind of apex predator, because our apex predators, our hunters, are supporting this department too. And the whole American model, North American model, is based in this concept of utilizing the conservation motivations of hunters and their interest in hunting to support conservation. So that's the hardest part. I think that, you know, when I look at the wolf, with the work of the Wolf Advisory Group and the progress they're making in relation to figuring out when lethal removal is appropriate in response to cattle or livestock depredations, it's going to be even harder when you turn to the predator management necessary to keep our ungulate populations huntable at surplus levels for human beings. So I just feel like somehow you've this spreadsheet is, or the flow chart is a helpful tool, but that first step of deciding, you know, when it's hunting, I mean, it's a sensitive one for people.
I agree, and I hunt, and so I'm well aware of how that works. So I don't know, is this doesn't have to be just reduced hunting opportunity. There's ways to model and pull out harvest out of a system, and so it doesn't necessarily have to be an experimental go reduce it and see what happens kind of thing. Not to say that that's maybe out there something you could do, but there are other ways to model removing hunting out of the system to see if that would turn the needle.
Okay. Well, I'll let other commissioners.
Yeah. This is the beginning of a long journey.
That's when you go to 400 level.
Yeah.
Thank you. Great presentation, Mick. There was a Mule Deer Summit last week up in Okanagan, and some great speakers, and there was a study that we heard about, University of Washington's Carolyn Shores, her fawn mortality study, which was eye-opening for me of, you know, what predators killing what amount of fawns during the course of a fawn season. Interesting, something I'm sure you're aware of. But my question is, and my thoughts are, that I think as hunters, we tend to think of, if there's more hunters, there's going to be more deer taken or more ungulates taken. And if you increase those number of hunters, it's always going to be more animals taken. I mean, that's intuitive. What I'm starting to think more and more is the thought of, with predators on the natural landscape, we can shoot coyotes till we're blue in the face. They come back. And it doesn't seem to affect, you know, the fawns that they kill, the numbers. And yet put wolves into that same scenario, and those coyotes are going to react to that territory. And from what I've heard and understand, they don't like to share the same territory. So they've kind of displaced one or another. Cougars, I tend to, what I've read, they tend to seek higher ground or more remote ground where wolves are back. So to me, it's going to be very interesting to see, and I'd like to see research pointed at not just predator-prey relationships, but predator-to-predator-to-predator relationship, because I think we tend to think that it's kind of an additive thing. Now that we add more wolves to the equation, we're going to lose more deer and elk. And I'm not sure that's going to all play out that way. I'm sure there'll be an effect, but the relationship between the predators themselves is not like humans. They'll take care of some things amongst themselves and the population and their territories. And I'd really like to know, the final answer is, to me, is what is the overall effect of all predators now that this new one's back on the scene, right, to ungulate populations? Then the human part of it comes in, of course, and we need our hunting population, and we need to keep them happy. I just want to point out, I guess, that the research that might be needed is not just predator to prey, but also predators as they affect each other, and then how that affects prey.
And you're exactly right. I didn't include it on this slide, but that's been part of our discussion, is predator to predator interaction as well. That's something that University of Washington staff are also interested in. So it's on the table and being discussed.
Mr. Keeney?
I mean,
you know who. Thank you, Chair.
J2.
I guess this is more of a comment, and I had a birthday last week, and I'm kind of getting to the point where you get a little reflective because you're about to go from the third to the fourth quarter. And it's one of those things that gets bounced around here on a pretty regular basis. This is the best science. This is the best science. And a word of caution to some of you younger guys, I'm in two industries that are nothing like what they are today. Today is what they were 30 years ago. All of forestry is done completely different, with different equipment, different goals, everything else. Farming, same thing. Bottom plows, rusty in the fence row, now we're direct seeding and all kinds of things like that. Proper science is always being challenged. Galileo was laughed at one point in time. I heard a really good deal about Einstein the other day. Same thing. Always, he was laughed at, impugned. So we all, true science, when you hear one thing that's bounced around today a lot is the science is settled on global warming. True science is never settled. It's always being challenged. So I guess one thing I'm going to leave you with, I think this is a Mark Twain quote, but common sense, that is brilliance in its working clothes. So always remember that. And when stuff starts going against common sense, you need to remember it. So thank you.
Appreciate it.
Any other questions?
So we heard you explain and show a number of charts about equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all kind of, I would think you would agree, oversimplified,
yeah,
but the concept is informative. But nature really doesn't ever conform to simple bell-shaped curves, maybe on a gross level. So you talk about equilibrium, and I've always mulled over, well, if you know, we've got advanced brains, we could probably manipulate equilibrium, because it's not just a matter of habitat carrying capacity. We could always feed more of one thing and weed out whatever we don't like. So we have the capacity to manipulate, and there's values associated. People differ on the extent to which we should or shouldn't manipulate nature. Well, we've got another manipulation going. Well, it's not. A lot of our manipulations lead to inadvertent consequences. And I think climate change is one of those big consequences. I think there's an expectation, a general and agreed expectation, that we will see changes, big changes on the landscape because of climate change, which throws into question, you know, a lot of these things that created the former equilibriums. The habitat carrying capacity will, you know, if climate change is true, and it will alter in a very fundamental way things like carrying capacity. So it just suggests to me that we may be at this point in time going through a period of real destabilization, and that all of these notions of equilibrium may not give us as much guidance as previous times. And it comes to mind that so I'll get to one of, I guess, the questions. Blue tongue disease, like some of the other phenomenon we're seeing, we've seen it in the past, but it is possible that it's just going to get a heck of a lot worse than ever before because of these climate changes or the impacts on and droughts and floods and things, extreme weather patterns. So these factors that have been unleashed create stresses on prey populations. So it seems like common sense to me that we would do what we can to take the pressure off the prey populations. We're recovering wolves, and maybe that isn't creating a big additive effect. Who knows? Maybe in some places it is. But if there's already all these stresses going on in these prey populations, we just shouldn't assume that the equilibrium will sort itself out, it seems to me. But what, so yeah. Respond to all
so
of that.
That's a lot to respond to, I think. I'm not sure we have all that time. But generally, you know, those kind of abiotic factors, those things that aren't the weather patterns and the temperature changes and things like that are things that are need to be part of our flow chart in a way and part of our thought process. That you know, when we're thinking, I'll just grab moose for a minute, and you know, they're temperature sensitive animals. We need, you know, they've expanded quite a ways south. If things are changing, and you mentioned blue tongue, if it, you know, is moving further north, there are things like that that we have to think of, and they are in our thought process when we're kind of thinking about what's affecting the ungulate population, and I think that's one of the pieces that needs to be in there, and it's definitely part of the conversation.
Mr. Thornburg.
So Commissioner Wecker's comment and question actually made me want to ask a question that I was sort of thinking about. And as someone who has worked with the prey species and predator control, it's kind of a question that I've had on my mind. When you present the models and the literature, it seems that predator control comes in when you have a population decline, and the idea is to restore it to the carrying capacity population. Has predator control ever been used in small populations to actually boost the population?
Absolutely. You know, that's when I'm thinking about you know, sage grouse or pygmy rabbits. Those, or let me even give a more example that I've worked with directly when I was working out in our Region 6. That we, the state of Oregon, went into their plover population and our plover populations were just in the handfuls of birds. Oregon started off about 4 years ago doing a corvid control program in their area. You know, and there's a lot of anthropogenic or, you know, human-caused reasons along the coast where ravens and crows are much more abundant now than they've ever been. But they went into a program and starting off literally with just handfuls of plovers, and now they've got hundreds, and have taken that very small population and done predator control and got a response to where, you know, hopefully it gets to a point where you get to on that curve that says, well, you can remove the predator control and it stays up here. Sometimes it's a little sketchy on whether you want to pull that trigger or not, because you don't know if it's going to go back down or not. But yes, small populations, there's been that's been one of the key pieces. Mm-hmm.
So is it dependent on the predator? Because I'm thinking coyotes and.
Right. Well, that's the long-term investment, right? If they, there's been studies about coyote control that once you stop, they just, you know, bounce back. So you're in it for the long haul on that until you get some size of population that won't be affected by that. And that's sometimes the hard thing.
Sticking to schedule. Thank you, Mick. Good article on crows in this month's Audubon, if you haven't read it.
Oh, I haven't.
Intelligence. It's really...
Oh, they're intelligent.
Smart critter.
Absolutely.